Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Spirituality and Mindfulness, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jack Petranker. I'm one of the hosts here. And today we're going to be talking with Ira Helderman. Ira's new book is called Prescribing the Dharma. So Ira, welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. I think it's a really interesting book, and I'm sure this is going to be a great conversation. So to start off, can you tell us something about your background and then how you came to write this book?
Sure. So my background is a little unusual for religious studies. Religious studies is actually a second or at least second path for me. I am a practicing therapist. I've been working in the mental health field in one capacity or another since 2001. And it was as a therapist that I first, was introduced to material that I was told was Buddhist teachings and practices. And I was introduced to the idea that Buddhist teachings and practices could be helpful in psychotherapy. At some point, I became curious about that, about how therapists, many of whom define themselves as not religious practitioners, were drawing from traditions that they also defined to be as religious. And it was in part that curiosity that led me to totally change my life's direction and take up a whole new path of religious studies, and I began working towards a PhD in religion. My degree is in religion is religion, psychology, and culture, and I began that in 2009. And the ultimate culmination of those studies is my book, Prescribing the Dharma.
Okay, great. That really is a radical shift. You tell a story in the book about attending a conference at which the Dalai Lama was speaking, and it was a conference for psychotherapists, and it just struck you as strange or remarkable that a group of psychotherapists would be looking to a Buddhist spiritual teacher for guidance in how to be better psychotherapists. But still, from that moment of thinking it's strange to deciding you were going to make a radical shift in your career, that's a big jump. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, Well, there's probably a lot to say about it. I mean, I pinpoint that moment because I can actually remember that moment as being a shift. I imagine lots of people sitting in the room with the Dalai Lama have had shifts of various sorts. But the fact is that for a long time I had thought about the way in which people defined psychotherapy as not religious, and the way they often defined help around mental health and well-being as coming from what usually they would use the word spiritual sources, but also religious sources and religious communities. And so I had been thinking about those dynamics for some time. But it was that moment in the conference room of looking around again, a conference sponsored by Cambridge Health Alliance, an affiliate of Harvard Medical School, and thinking, so many of these practitioners, probably not all of them, but so many of them define themselves as not religious, and they're listening to, what was once a theocratic leader of a nation state, and for so many people, a deity, and that encounter is not unique. There are lots of other factors that led to my actually taking up religious studies scholarship. I had been working in a university counseling center for some years and was thinking of going into private practice. But in thinking of leaving the counseling center, I had, many paths were sort of open to me. As much as anything, it came from conversations from the person that ended up becoming my first reader, my dissertation advisor, a man named Volney Gay, who is a kind of classical psychoanalyst of religion, which means psychologist of religion, which means that he would use psychoanalytic ideas to interpret why people are religious, in what way are people religious. And he was one of the faculty, one of the lead faculty for this program in religious studies on religion and psychology. And as much as anything, it was out of conversations with him that when I was thinking of, I'm leaving this counseling center, I'm starting a new phase of my life, what am I going to be doing? And I knew what I was passionate about.
Okay. So I'm curious about that. Before you made that shift and you were in the counseling center, were your clients mostly students then, or is that the group you were working with?
So the counseling center I worked for was really unique. At the time it was unique. It is very unique now in that we did not just treat students. We treated the students. We treated undergrad and then graduate students, so med students, law students, so on. But we also treated faculty and staff and then dependents of students, faculty, and staff. So, I was working with undergraduate students, graduate students, faculty members, partners of faculty, children of staff members. And so, it was a training site for a lot of people, and they were able to get a wide expanse of experience. Incidentally, I was working with divinity students, and they were definitely some of them, some of my the famous people, not famous, my favorite people to work with.
Okay, so yeah, that leads me to where I was going with that question. Really, before you made this shift, did you find that spiritual issues? We'll get into what that means, but did you find that those were coming up in your work with your clients?
Well, I think that when you say, "Well, define what that means," that's kind of the key piece there. So, what I'll say is my answer then is actually the same as my religious studies scholar answer now, which is that there were many people that defined the issues that they were working with as spiritual issues. I had people that defined the issues that they worked with as spiritual abuse, as having experienced spiritual abuse. Some people were mm-hmm. actively working through their relationship to their religiosity and spirituality. But, there's surely someone that could come along and look at a particular person that was coming to see me for therapy who may not have defined the issues that they were working with as religious or spiritual, but that to that outside person, they would say, oh, that's all about spiritual issues, or maybe they would say those are all about existential issues, and whether they would make a difference, make a distinction there is a whole other.
Right. That's really interesting to me. I'm going to get maybe more personal than is appropriate, but many years ago, I was in therapy for a little while, for a few months. And I remember that because I am a practicing Buddhist, I remember that when I was looking around for a therapist, I said, well, I would like somebody who's a Buddhist, basically. And I remember when I went into his office, I was pleased because he had a tanka of the medicine Buddha on his wall. But then once the therapy started, I don't think we really did anything with spiritual issues. Now, I don't remember, it was years ago. But
I'd be so curious to know how that, you know, would play out today. And because you were saying this many years ago, and I suspect that that we could probably track the way some of these changes have taken place in terms of how therapists are, you know, respond to somebody's religious affiliation, identity, practice, et cetera. You know, over the last few decades, that's changed radically. And I see that in my teaching of graduate students in counseling. I can see how from addition of textbook to addition to textbook, that has changed. And we can see that in the DSM. And I should say that those kind of issues I am interested in continuing to do research on in general. I think of my religious studies research as having an umbrella topic of how psychotherapists and psychotherapeutic stuff affects the way people are religious today and vice versa. I hope to be able to explore some of these more general topics over time.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And yes, based on my experience as a sample of one, things certainly have changed a lot over the course of these decades in that relationship. Maybe I'll head back more into the actual material of your book at this point. So you define six different approaches that psychotherapists have taken to Buddhist traditions, if that's the right way to say it. And I thought maybe that would be a nice way, kind of an outline for how we could proceed. So let me just mention them, and then we can go into them and see where that takes us. So you say that psychotherapists have therapized Buddhism, have filtered it, have translated it, have personalized it, have adopted it, or have integrated it. I think I learned a lot in reading your book about how that, about those different possibilities, because I certainly wouldn't have been able to tease all those different categories out myself. So let's start with the first, psychotherapists therapizing Buddhism. Can you say something about that?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing I always try to really stress as strongly as I can is that these categories are totally artificial. They are just a hopefully helpful rubric to try to map out the diversity of ways that therapists have approached Buddhist traditions throughout history. And that's one of the main things I'm trying to convey in the book, is that especially at a time right now where I think, as I say in the book, conversations about mindfulness practices can kind of swallow everything up like a black hole. There have been a diversity of ways beyond incorporating mindfulness practices that therapists have approached Buddhist traditions. And another central argument I make is that the ways and that diversity of ways that they approach Buddhist traditions can be sort of mapped out by they're generated, I should say, from the various ways that therapists have defined what is and is not religious to them. And so each of these categories is named after that. So and each of the titles for the categories that I gave comes from the interviews and reading I did of therapists themselves. So it's their language to a large degree. So to get at what I'm saying about how definitions of religious and not religious shape the way therapists approach Buddhist traditions, we can start with doing what you've asked me to say something about therapizing religion first. And so when I say that therapists therapize religion, what I'm saying there is that you have different therapists who believe that a certain element, a teaching, a practice, a text, is religious. And for a variety of reasons, based on how they'd want to define themselves as a practitioner, how invested they are often in being defined as not religious practitioners, they will therapize that religious element. And what that means is that they'll evaluate that teaching, text, or practice based on their not just psychological ideas, but psychotherapeutic ideas about illness and health. So some of the earliest therapists to take an interest in Buddhist tradition, some took therapizing religion approaches. So people like Carl Jung, therapized religion in his approach to Buddhist traditions. And so what he did is he looked at particular ideas like the idea of rebirth and used therapeutic ideas about the collective unconscious, our will maybe to return to a narcissistic state of the womb and childhood development, to interpret this is what this idea of rebirth is really about for Buddhists. And the earliest therapists did take these therapizing religion approaches, but therapists to this day will therapize various Buddhist teachings and practices amongst the other approaches that they'll take to Buddhist traditions. You'll regularly hear people say, they'll assert that Buddhist practice is based on, for example, inhibition of certain emotions like desire or anger, which is potentially a problematic claim, but many people do believe that. And they'll say, let's look at how psychologically healthy that is to inhibit an emotion like desire or anger. Some therapists will choose what they do and do not incorporate into their psychotherapeutic models based on those therapizing religion conclusions.
Okay, that makes sense. And let me ask you, I'm going to skip for a moment here, but how's that different from translating Buddhist traditions? That was the third category you mentioned.
Sure. So in translating religion approaches, therapists will take a particular teaching and practice and attempt to translate it into a not religious, what they define as not religious item, so as to incorporate it into therapy. So they might therapize a particular practice as well as translate it. But when we're therapizing, when a therapist is therapizing a Buddhist teaching, they are evaluating it using psychotherapeutic ideas, analyzing it using psychotherapeutic ideas. And when a therapist is translating a Buddhist practice, it's usually for the purpose of actually incorporating it into therapy. I say that these approaches came out of a desire to both incorporate Buddhist practices while remaining not religious. And so someone like Carl Jung it would never have even occurred to him to incorporate a Buddhist practice into actual therapy. He knew that people of European descent were taking up Buddhist practices, and he addressed that and thought that alone was really, really problematic. But the idea of incorporating into psychotherapy wouldn't even have occurred to him. So he was all doing everything from afar. But later therapists were thinking these ideas should be incorporated into therapy in a variety of ways, but they need to be translated. The religiosity has to be removed from them before they can be incorporated into clinical work.
Okay. I think I understand.
Mindfulness practices is just the most famous example of translating religion practices. And so the chapter that looks at translating religion focuses on mindfulness practices as a case study.
When you talk about translating versus therapizing, then, if I understand correctly, psychotherapists who therapized Buddhism, in a way, they were standing not only outside it, but standing above it, saying, here's what the Buddhists were really doing. You know, here's what was really going on. And I'm going to make, you know, that may be valuable, they were not taking in any way a Buddhist stance, whereas translating, it's more kind of a level of equality. Is that a fair description?
I definitely wouldn't define translating religion approaches as when therapists take translating religion approaches, they're thinking of it in terms of equality. But though there are therapists who are very concerned with that idea of equality, so maybe we can come back to that. Here's the first thing I would say and really emphasize. What I'm describing are the way that therapists imagine their relationship to be to Buddhist traditions. So I borrowed a phrase to convey this distance I'm describing with therapizing religion approaches from someone I consider to be at least somewhat a mentor, a woman named Anne Harrington, who has written on this topic, been very generous with her time with me. And she used the phrase, look, but don't touch. And so certainly that was Jung's attitude was, although he did touch some and experimented some, which starts to get to the point. But what he said was that people of European descent could study Buddhist teachings and practices. There were things to learn from them as long as they were evaluated and through the frame of psychotherapeutic understanding. But people of European descent shouldn't touch these practices. It would be ultimately impossible for them to authentically practice a Buddhist path. But the thing is that he's still touching this, even when he's imagining that there's a distance there. He's still being influenced by that study, and so the idea that one cannot be influenced, that one can draw a hard boundary line and restrict Buddhist teachings from entering their psychotherapy, even as they're studying those studying those Buddhist texts, is I think an idea we want to be at the least curious about. When it comes to therapists taking translating religion approaches, what I would say is that some of them explicitly say, quote unquote, we need to make these practices ours, which definitely also seems to set up a hierarchical sort of relationship where there's an evaluation of, you know, what is religious here and what is helpful here and what needs to be translated into therapy and whatnot. So I still think that there's an imagined hierarchical relationship, but time and again in each chapter of the book, I try to show the relational configurations that therapists imagine that they're making between Buddhist and psychotherapeutic, religious and not religious, whether that not religious be secular, scientific, medical, so on, and the way in which those relationships break down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so therapists may have one view of what's going on, but if you look at how they actually work in practice, you're saying it may be rather different.
In part, that is what I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah. Let me. As you were speaking, I started thinking of an analogy, and maybe I'm not sure it's so helpful, but let me try it out and see how you'd fit that in these different categories. So suppose that you become familiar, someone becomes familiar with another culture, and they have a way of preparing food. And they have certain recipes they follow, and they get some very tasty food as a result. And then you look at it and you say, well, that's really interesting. Maybe I could do that. But, you know, I'm going to have to really adapt it because we don't have the same spices. We don't use the same cooking methods, you know. But I think there's something there. I think I can make a really good meal if I do this. How would you compare that? Or is that at all a good comparison?
I like that a lot. And, you know, I use the metaphor of a recipe myself. Actually, in the Translating Religion chapter that focuses on translating religion approaches to Buddhist traditions, except the way that I was thinking of it, of that metaphor, was there are some people that say, if you take up a certain Buddhist concept or a certain Buddhist practice, regardless of why you take it up, or the context with which you take it up. So a therapist in their office, a corporate raider in their office, if whatever the context and whatever the motive, maybe the motive is to military officer trying to calm themselves so that they can, you know, have better aim. But like a recipe, if you follow the recipe precisely, if you whatever the motive and whatever the context, it will still have the same result. The argument from some of the therapists I spoke to is, regardless of the motive, regardless of the context, if they do it properly, they will, this practice or this teaching is going to bring various results such as enlightenment. Right. And so, you know, in the example that in the way that you were using the metaphor, the question is, well, what if you change some of the ingredients? And I think that if you talk about changing the ingredients, some people say, well, the result is always going to be different because the ingredients are different. It may be a cousin, it may be related, it may have certain resemblances, but it won't actually be the same result. So the enlightenment experiences would be different, or the insights that would be cultivated would be different. The compassion and loving kindness that, you know, would come up would be different in some way. I think these are some of the conversations that therapists are having. Is, does the context matter? Does the motive matter? Do the precise ingredients matter?
Okay, yeah, I think that is helpful. That's great. It leads me to ask a question about context in the broadest sense. And I'm thinking here of something that I believe you quote David McMahon as saying, which is that the context, the traditional Buddhist context, you could say, was really not about getting along better in your life, you know, learning to be more at ease, learning to be more present even, but really cutting through the ordinary way of engaging the world and really, you know, leaving home, as it says in the traditional Buddhist texts, you know, rather than trying to adjust or accommodate or expand what it's like to live at home. if we use that analogy, you know, you don't just add another house onto another room onto your house, but you move to another country. You know? So in that sense, the context is really different. Do therapists worry about that or discuss that?
So if I understand your question correctly, generally, I think you're asking, does context matter? And David McMahon is a major influence on my work. He was actually an outside reader on my dissertation committee. And he has written and spoken a great deal about how the context with which people take up various meditation practices does matter tremendously. And I think that therapists are also discussing that question. You know, it seems hard to deny that the context is not going to have a major influence. The example that I always think of is one that I feel like doesn't get talked about enough, and that is a word I used a few moments ago, and that's rebirth. So if you believe that the way that the universe works is through a constant process of karmic cause and effect, and that we are we're all bound up in that and are going to be reborn based on that series of karmic cause and effect, and you believe that that is a kind of ensnarement that you're looking to escape, and that is just a different worldview, that's a different understanding of time and reality than someone that believes something very different. And if one is taking up certain practices or taking up a certain path in order to try to escape karmic ensnarement, that's a very different a motive. This is something very, very much different that you're bringing to the practice, we might say, than someone who is looking to soothe their anxiety symptoms. But again, there are people that say, well, regardless of what those two individuals may be, or those two communities may be thinking that they're doing as they're taking up those practices, it's all going to lead to the same thing. And you'll hear people interpret therapize the concept of rebirth and to say that actually what's actually happening here is they're going to be achieving a different X kind of well-being, and so will the person in the therapy office. And so there are debates going on about those questions. There's much more to be said about that, but hopefully that's enough to pique people's interest to find more on those questions in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Right. Yeah, there's much more to be said. One of the things that struck me about your book is there's just so much material in it. And, you know, there's so many different ways that the therapists have been engaging Buddhism. It just is a vast topic. But I think you've done a great job of laying it out in the way that people can really begin to explore on their own.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let's go back and, well, no, let me ask one more question about that. There's someone else that you quote, and it really has to do with this distinction between liberation or enlightenment as a goal and self-realization as a goal. And that is also a kind of context question, isn't it? Are you practicing with self-realization in mind, or are you practicing with, what shall we call it, an escape from samsara in mind?
Yes. So the first chapter, after the introduction, the first chapter of the book tries to lay out the different terms that I'm working with. I've said that I'm trying to learn more about how people define what is and is not religious by looking at how communities of therapists define what is and is not religious and the way it shapes their behavior and how they approach Buddhist tradition. So in that first chapter, I look at what I call therapists' conventional definition of religion and categories of the not religious, like science, medicine, so on. But the final really set of concepts that I lay out in that first chapter is what we might call ultimate aims. Now I'm blanking. I think it was Tillich that referred to the to ultimate aims.
Right. Right. Ultimate concerns.
Ultimate concerns. And so for therapists, many people, you know, for many therapists, the aim of therapy is health. But different therapists define health to mean very different things. For some people, the aim of therapy, the result of therapy, or the result of human existence, is supposed to be, you know, to achieve a state of ultimate health. But that health could be wholeness. It could be this concept, this word, well-being, or it could be enlightenment. For some therapists, they will say, if you are adopting a medical model where the only thing you're working towards is trying to reduce someone's symptoms to get rid of an illness, then you are potentially even doing harm to that person, when instead you should be attending to their full flourishing. And what is that full flourishing? Some therapists would say that is a Buddhist-defined enlightenment. Now, not escape from samsara, but various therapists have defined that concept of enlightenment in very different ways. It might be self-liberation. It might be interconnectedness, and so on.
I think I understand the point you're making, and one of the reasons it gets a little complicated is that people, as you point out, in Buddhist communities, people in their understanding of Buddhism is shaped by what therapists have had to say about Buddhism, and then therapists who look at what's being taught in the Buddhist tradition are drawing on contemporary teachers who are already incorporating some psychological ideas. So it becomes, in a way, difficult to maintain the separation. I mean, they tend to blend into each other.
I think this is a really important point that can often get missed as people sort of can debate about what is authentically Buddhist or not, is that the Buddhist communities, the Buddhist teachings and practices that the vast majority of psychotherapists, you know, have encountered and then are deciding, maybe I base a whole therapy around this Buddhist doctrine I'm learning about, or maybe I can't do that because that would make my therapy religious. So, but maybe I can kind of adopt it or hold it in my heart in a session, so, and et cetera, et cetera. The Buddhist doctrine, the Buddhist teachings and practices that we're talking about there are introduced in very particular Buddhist communities. By and large, what are, you know, it's debatable if this is the best term, but what is often referred to as convert Buddhist communities. So in Buddhist communities that are populated largely by people of European descent who were not raised by people that identified as Buddhists, that is already meditation centric, is using English language texts, etc., rather than the Laotian immigrant community Buddhist temple that might be down the street. They're learning, here in Nashville, they're being introduced to Buddhist teachings and practices in those convert Buddhist communities. And those Buddhist communities' understanding of what is enlightenment is very different from, or what the purpose of practices are, is different from that Laotian temple, which would be concerned with things like merit making and propitiation divinities and so on. And so now, already when they're thinking about how do I translate this Buddhist doctrine, or how do I hold this Buddhist concept in, silently within my person in a session, or so how do I adopt this Buddhist practice? When they're thinking about those Buddhist practices and teachings as defined by those convert Buddhist communities, which to some Buddhist study scholars of historical Buddhist traditions already seem very different from what has historically been defined as Buddhist teachings and practices. And then we take it one step further to note that those same convert Buddhist communities are themselves often, have been led by or founded by psychotherapists like Jack Kornfield. It gets, to me, super fascinating and interesting when we start thinking about the nature of all of this when we take all of that into consideration.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting and very rich. Let's go back. I want to get back into your scheme for analyzing this, and we skipped over psychotherapists who filter Buddhism. Can you say something about that?
Sure. So filtering religion approaches to Buddhist traditions is where therapists, psychologists believe that they can take scientific, psychological tools and instruments and filter out the religiosity from a particular teaching or practice. So there are a lot, this is in the chapter that treats this, I spend a lot of time on the neuroscientific study of Buddhist meditation. And there are, I quote psychotherapists that are really excited about that research. And what they're saying is, because this research shows a particular practice to be efficacious, it means that it can be used and without in a non-religious context. And so the idea is that scientific methods and instruments can filter away the religiosity from Buddhist teachings and practices, and can leave aside sort of filtered essence to the Buddhist to Buddhist traditions, akin to sort of a filtered coffee. So okay. I say that I look at neuroscientific studies of Buddhist traditions in that chapter, but I also argue that that neuroscientific study is the latest iteration of what a discipline that called science, the psychology of religion. And I also look at that history in the chapter as well, the way the first psychologists of religion approached Buddhist traditions, folks like William James and James Bissett Pratt.
Okay. Yeah. So the example that comes to my mind, and I think you refer to it, but you don't go into the details, is something that Don Lopez writes about, an example that he opens a chapter in a book about, where scientists have a monk meditating in their lab, and he's doing a very complex visualization. He's a Tibetan monk. And for him, I mean, the visualization is what it's all about. But all they're doing is measuring his body temperature to see whether doing the visualization has an impact on the body temperature. It does seem like you're missing something kind of fundamental when you do that, when you filter. I mean, it seems like that's a possible danger, right?
Well, that is one of the things that therapists are sort of debating about. So some therapists would say, well, that imaginaire that Buddhist monk is engaged with when they're visualizing these vast Buddhist cosmographies, that play that monk is engaged in serves a psychotherapeutic purpose, but it's not literally real. And it's important that that at some point that monk comes to reality that that's not literally real. They need to come out of that illusion in order to be fully healthy.
I see.
There are some therapists that would say that. There are other therapists that would say there is something that's being removed and excised when that's not attended to. Although when we're talking about that example, there are few, in fact, there was no therapist that I read or interviewed or heard speaking at a conference that said, you know, the super mundane powers of bodhisattvas are literally real and attainable. There are some that still wanted to attend to those to that imagery and iconography, but still perceived it to be as metaphors.
Okay, well, I guess that's right. In your last categories, maybe that'll become an issue again. But okay, let's take a look at the fourth one, because I think this is also really important. The fourth category you have is a therapist who personalize Buddhist traditions. So what do you have in mind there? What do you discuss there?
Sure. And I kind of referred to it earlier. There are therapists out there that, you know, share that they have been deeply, deeply touched by Buddhist teachings and practices. Some who say that they've been utterly transformed by Buddhist experiences. But to an outside observer looking at their therapy sessions, that outside observer may have no idea that that person is a Buddhist. That therapist may believe that there's something, you know, essentially, to use that word again, Buddhist about their sessions, but there's no mention of Buddhist teachings and practices. There's no incorporation of Buddhist practices. And so, again, to the outside observer, they would have no sense that there there is anything Buddhist about those sessions. And I should say that some therapists, I was referring to some therapists who believe that the sessions are still at heart, to use that phrase deeply, Buddhist. But there are some that say, no, my Buddhist path is separate from my psychotherapeutic path. I keep those two things separate. I may even lead a Buddhist community, and some of the people that I read and interviewed are this case where they lead Buddhist communities. They teach people in meditation, but they see all of that as totally separate from their Buddhist practice, and instead it's all held silently within their person, and thus I call that personalizing Buddhist traditions. Some of the early seeds of that kind of attitude, I say, is in the work of people like Eric Fromm, who believed that therapists, analysts should study Buddhist teachings and practices. It might take, you know, practice meditation in their quote unquote personal life. And that those insights should be incorporated into psychoanalysis, but wouldn't actually have an analysis and meditate in a therapy session. For the most part, these were folks like Eric Fromm were engaging with Buddhist teachings on a theoretical level, and that theoretical engagement would again remain in their mind, remain in them internally. And in the case of Fromm, he believed that that Buddhist traditions were an example of a humanistic religion. And so I take it one step further that for him, authentic religiosity was personalized humanistic religiosity. There's a lot more to be said about that point, but again, hopefully it's enough to pique a listener's interest.
Yeah, no, that's really good. You know, and one of the examples, one of the things you point out that I certainly had never thought of, because it's kind of a professional issue, is that a lot of therapists are in circumstances where, somebody has to be paying for this therapy session, an insurance company or whoever. And so they're maybe going to be disinclined to have someone meditate in a therapy session, because someone who's looking at that through a two-way mirror will recognize that as a religious practice, and then there's a risk that they may not authorize payment on it.
This is another hugely important point that I emphasize throughout the book, and is one of my central findings that I describe in the conclusion to the book. And that is, you know, therapists are constantly maneuvering with a variety of institutional affiliations and authorities. So a therapist that identifies, I was referring to psychoanalysts earlier, a therapist that identifies as a psychoanalyst is going to approach what elements that they think of as religious in a very different way from a therapist that identifies as transpersonal. If they're trying to belong to that community have membership in certain associations, they're going to be thinking of those in those terms. And then there are many others. If you work in a hospital setting versus in private practice, if you're negotiating with an insurance utilization review, if you're thinking in terms of state laws, in some cases, you're going to be thinking all of those factors contribute to the decisions that therapists make when they are approaching material that they believe is religious, as they are thinking of themselves as not religious practitioners, or in some cases, not so religious practitioners. And so those institutional authorities, those institutional factors are constantly at work, whether they be economic motives at play there, or identity issues, just how I identify and want to identify myself, the self-surveillance I'm under, or the actual surveillance in a sense that a supervisor might be engaged in looking through that two-way mirror, although supervisors rarely use those two-way mirrors these days.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, it looks very different from the point of view of the therapist and the point of view of the person who seeks out therapy, right? Because they're not going to be thinking about these issues,
They might be. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I think that is one of the major factors at work here, is that there are some people that are expressively looking for not religious help for a variety of reasons. They are looking for a therapist. They may have belonged to a religious community of some sort and have found that to be helpful in some ways or hurtful in other ways. And they're looking for a practitioner that they would define as being not religious. And so it would be disturbing to them to think that they, you know, were sitting across from somebody that is, incorporating something that they define to be religious, or vice versa. So staying with, you know, just going through the different approaches, one of the things I found most interesting about therapists will take sometimes personalizing religion approaches, amongst other, because many therapists are using multiple approaches at the same time, but is that, you know, they may be sought out. Some of those therapists may be sought out precisely because they have they're a public figure as leader of a Buddhist community, or they've published on, you know, books on Zen and psychotherapy. One of my interviewees, or a couple of them, Polly Young Eisendrath and Barry Imagine, they've published books on Zen and with titles like Zen and psychotherapy. And so a person who is looking for a therapist who does that kind of work might see that they've written those books and seek them out precisely because that they've written those books. But if they did, or at least at one point, if they did, when I did the interviews with them, if they did, they'd be told, actually, if you're interested in that, you'll want to come to my to my Zendo, or we can set up some meditation teaching. But here in when we're doing therapy, that's its own thing, and that wouldn't be here. So I do think that the expectations of the people of the help seeker are very much at play, because those conversations are also influencing what therapists are doing. As I say, more and more people might be seeking out somebody
Right.
No,
I understand that. And it sounds like, if we take a look at the final two categories that you discuss, that might be exactly where you see a shift, because then the fifth category is therapists who have adopted Buddhism or Buddhist teachings. So there it would be up front, right?
Yes. So, I talk about how psychotherapists have taken what I call adopting religion approaches to Buddhist traditions in a few different ways. In this chapter, I don't just talk about therapists who, might fully adopt Buddhist teachings and practices as the basis of their therapies. And so they're explicitly maybe talking about the Four Noble Truths as they understand them, having been introduced to them in these convert Buddhist communities. So there are those therapists who I define as taking adopting religion approaches. But I also talk about therapists talk about Buddhist communities there and how they are adopting, how therapists who belong to Buddhist communities may be, in their personal life, having, fully adopted kind of a Buddhist identity while maybe not in their practice. So I talk mm-hmm. about that as well.
Okay. No, I see that difference. And is that then, are we kind of moving on a scale? And then when we get to the sixth category of therapists who've integrated Buddhist traditions, is that more, where in a therapy session they would actually be bringing up Buddhist themes?
Well, I try very hard to not think about it precisely because, the person that who is adopting, who believes that they are fully adopting Buddhist doctrine into their therapy, a Buddhist studies scholar might come along and say, that's just as quote unquote secularized as anything else, and so, right. What I would say is that therapists do think about it in terms of those scales, and do think about therapists will observe each other and say this person is more or less Buddhist and might be engaged in that. The final category I do call integrating religion approaches to Buddhist traditions, and there, we could say that all these approaches are in one way or another integrating approaches. But the distinction I make for the sake of the chapter is that here is where therapists are intentionally and actively believe that they are integrating or synthesizing. They use there's about 10 different words we could use here, and therapists dislike integrating, or they'll like a different synthesizing, or they're for different reasons to describe what they're doing. But the point is that they will believe that the therapy is both distinctly Buddhist and distinctly psychotherapeutic at the same time, and they're trying to maintain that sense of differentiation and incorporation at the same time, and in a variety of sort of ways.
Okay. I think, I don't want to take too much more of your time. So I think that's probably a good place to end, except for a coda. Let me just ask you where you're going now. What kind of work are you doing now?
Well, I am continuing to be engaged in this work, looking as I'm talking about the book, and I'm trying to talk about some of the topics that are kind of most live around these issues, such as informed consent is what I'm currently writing for Psychology Today. The question of how, well, in particularly in the case of mindfulness practices, are therapists under an ethical obligation not just to give informed consent around the possible benefits and possible negative side effects of therapeutic mindfulness practices, but their origins as, in their minds, potentially religious or Buddhist, so on. So I continue to engage in those kind of topics. But my next major research project is looking at the concept of spirituality, this term spirituality, the work that it does for therapists and the way it's changed over time, and how psychotherapists and have contributed to the changing understanding of what is this concept spirituality, including, you know, the relatively new idea that it's something distinguished from religion. You know, most of the therapists I wrote about in Prescribing the Dharma, and I do some of this work in Prescribing the Dharma. If people are interested in this topic, it's one of those terms that I trace throughout the book. Most of the therapists I write about in Prescribing the Dharma use the word spiritual as a synonym for religion, but there may be some unconscious ways in which we can see the seeds of how the current dominant understanding that spirituality is something different from religion were laid in what therapists have said about spirituality. And that's what I'm kind of, that's some of what I'm tracing today in my next project.
Okay, that really sounds interesting. I can't help but ask one more question since it raises that for me. And that is, you mentioned that there are therapists who will say, well, the work that I do as a therapist is spiritual, or might even say the work that I do as a therapist is religious if you take a broad enough sense of what is meant by religion. And I was a little surprised to hear that. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is, again, you know, the title of my book is Prescribing the Dharma, Psychotherapists, Buddhist Traditions, and Defining Religion. And you know, what you're asking about is precisely that last part of the subtitle. You know, the way in which communities in the U.S. define what is and is not religious. So for some, I think that therapists are an ideal community in some way, or I mean, communities of therapists are in some ways ideal for religious studies scholars to study this changing definitions of what is and is not religion, this relatively new concept in human history, because they will actively engage with the work that I'm doing right now is meant to, for a long time, this concept of self-realization was essential to many, many therapists. There are reasons why you hear less talk about self-actualization and self-realization in the last decade or two. But for many people, that they again, as I referred to earlier, would say a therapy that's based on a medical model about illness is actually doing harm to people. We need to help people to self-actualize. And what is religion to a therapist like Fromm or Jung, and Fromm would want me to emphasize in a very different way? They would say the heart of religion is actually self-actualization. And so in a way, authentic psychotherapy is meant to achieve what religious traditions to Jung and Fromm were meant to achieve. And that's this idea of self-actualization or self-realization. And so they were very much actively thinking with this. I mean, Jung believed that religion, believed in this idea that society was under a process of secularization, and that religious traditions were ultimately going to fall away. And he seemed to believe that his analytical psychology was going to take its place as fulfilling what religious traditions once did. All that to say, we can learn a lot about what, how people define the trajectory of society. People believe this secularization narrative for a long time. And we can, people believe that religious traditions are defined in this way and that way over time. And we can learn more about these concepts by looking at communities of psychotherapists, religious studies scholars can, I mean, and anyone else interested. And the way that they have approached Buddhist traditions is just one case study with which to do that.
Okay, that really is interesting, and it sounds like it's going to be a central theme in your next book. So we'll leave it there. We've been talking with Ira Helderman, and his book is called Prescribing the Dharma. So Ira, thanks a lot for taking the time, and thanks for the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. This has been wonderful.